Thank you, Judy. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us on this conference call. When I spoke a few weeks ago, I talked about the importance of building a bridge to the recovery and helping as many people and many businesses as possible get across that bridge. Over the past month, the scale of that national bridge-building task has grown in size, as our efforts to contain the virus have had to be stepped up. That bridge has had to be bigger, longer, and stronger. As a country, we've been up to the task. It's clear, though, that we will face some difficult days ahead. But Australians should take reassurance from the fact that all arms of public policy are pulling together. We're all working to make sure that the Australian economy will get through this difficult period and that we'll be well placed for the recovery on the other side. Today, I'd like to provide an update on the Reserve Bank's economic outlook and also an update on the implementation of the Reserve Bank's policy package announced a month ago. I'm going to start off with the economic outlook. As you would know, economic forecasting is difficult at the best of times. It's even harder at times like this than when we're experiencing a once-in-a-lifetime event. Given this, I don't think it makes sense at the moment to focus on forecasts to the nearest decimal point, as we're often prone to do. Instead, I'd like to focus on two broad issues. The first is the immediate outlook for the economy, and the second is the speed and nature of the economic recovery. In terms of the immediate outlook, the next few months are going to be very difficult ones for the Australian economy. One very obvious consequence of the efforts that are needed to contain the virus is that many normal activities can't take place at the moment. This means that for as long as these the various restrictions are in place, we don't have the jobs and we don't have the incomes that come from these normal activities. And on top of this, at the moment, there is a higher level of uncertainty about the future, which means that many households and businesses are holding back on their spending and investment. So the result of both the restrictions and this uncertainty is that over the first half of 2020, we are likely to experience the biggest contraction in national output and national income that we've witnessed since the 1930s. Putting precise numbers on the magnitude of this contraction is difficult, but our current thinking is along the following lines. National output is likely to fall by around 10% over the first half of 2020, with most of this decline occurring in the June quarter. Total hours worked in Australia are likely to decline by around 20% over the first half of the year, which is a staggeringly large number. The unemployment rate is likely to be around 10% by June, although I'm hopeful that it might be lower than this if businesses are able to retain their employees on lower hours. The unemployment rate would have certainly been much higher than this without the government's JobKeeper program. These are all very large numbers and ones that were inconceivable just a month or two ago. And they speak to the immense challenge that our society faces in containing the virus. In terms of inflation, we're also expecting a significant decline in the June quarter. The large fall in oil prices combined with the introduction of free childcare and the deferral or reduction in some price increases means that it's quite likely that year-ended headline inflation will turn negative in the June quarter. If so, this would be the first time since the early 1960s where the price level has fallen over a full year. In underlying terms, though, we expect inflation to remain positive. As the economic data roll in over the coming months, they will present a very sobering picture of the state of our economy. There will be many reports of record declines in economic statistics. As Australians digest this economic news, I would ask that we keep in mind that this period will pass and that a bridge has been built to get us to the other side. With the help of that bridge, we will recover and the economy will once again grow strongly. That bridge has been partly built with the help of Australia's strong balance sheets, in particular the strong balance sheets of our governments, our private banks, and of the Reserve Bank. Australia's long record of responsible fiscal policy has allowed governments to use their balance sheets to help smooth out the income shock and to offer protection to those most affected. In doing so, our governments are making a major difference. The strong balance sheets of our banks are also helping. By offering repayment deferrals, our banks are rightly acting as shock absorbers and helping the economy get through this difficult period. And as I'll speak about in a few minutes, the Reserve Bank itself is using our balance sheet to help keep funding costs low and credit available to both businesses and households. Without these strong balance sheets, we would have been in a much more difficult position. I would now like to turn to the speed and nature of the recovery. I think we can be confident that our economy will bounce back and that we will see it recover. We need to remember that once the virus is satisfactorily contained, all those factors that have made Australia such a successful and such a prosperous country will still be there. Inevitably, the timing and pace of the recovery depends upon how long we need to restrict economic activities, which in turn depends on how long it takes to effectively contain the virus. So it's difficult to be precise, and I think at the moment it makes sense to think in terms of scenarios. And consistent with this, the Reserve Bank will discuss some possible scenarios in the Statement of Monetary Policy, which we'll release in a few weeks' time. But one plausible scenario is that the various restrictions begin to be progressively lessened by around the middle of the year and are mostly removed by late in the year, perhaps with the exception of the restrictions on international travel. Under this scenario, we'd expect the economy to begin its bounce back in the September quarter and for that bounce back to strengthen from there. If this is how things play out, the economy could be expected to grow very strongly next year, with GDP growth of perhaps 6 or 7% after a fall of around 6% this year. There is, though, quite a lot of uncertainty around these numbers, with the exact profile of the recovery depending not only when the restrictions are lifted, but also on the resolution of the uncertainty that many people feel about the future. I think it's harder still to make forecasts about the unemployment rate, given the uncertainty about how many employees will remain attached to their firm and whether people who are stood down will be looking for employment and thus counted as unemployed. But it is likely that the unemployment rate will remain above 6% over the next couple of years. And with many firms delaying or cancelling wage increases, year-ended wage growth is expected to decline to below 2% before gradually picking up. And in underlying terms, inflation is expected to remain below 2% over the next couple of years and to reach 1% later this year. Of course, there are other scenarios as well. On the optimistic side, the restrictions could be lifted more quickly with the virus being contained. In that case, a stronger recovery could be expected, particularly in light of the very strong monetary and fiscal stimulus that's been put in place. On the other hand, though, if the restrictions stay in place longer, or they have to be reimposed, the recovery will be delayed and it will be interrupted. In that case, the loss of incomes and jobs could be even more pronounced than the scenario that I've outlined today. But whatever the timing of the recovery, when it does come, we should not be expecting that we will return quickly to business as usual. Rather, the twin health and economic emergencies that we're experiencing right now will cast a shadow over our economy for some time to come. It's highly probable that the severe shocks we're now experiencing will change the mindsets of some people and of some businesses. Even when the restrictions are lifted, it's probable that some of the precautionary behaviour that we're seeing at the moment will persist. And in the months ahead, we are likely to lose some businesses despite best efforts, and some of those businesses will not reopen. There will also be a higher level of debt, and many households might reevaluate the risks of having highly leveraged balance sheets. It's also probable that there will be structural changes in the economy. We're all learning to work, shop, and travel differently at the moment, and some of these changes will probably stay with us for some time, requiring a rethinking of business models. All this means that the crisis will have reverberations right through the economy for some time to come. The best way of dealing with these reverberations is to reinvigorate the country's growth and productivity agenda. As we look forward to the recovery, there is an opportunity to build on the cooperative spirit that is now serving us so well, to push forward with reforms that would move us out of the shadows that are going to be cast by the crisis. A strong focus on making Australia a great place for businesses to expand, invest, innovate and hire people is the best way of extending the recovery into a new period of strong and sustainable growth and rising living standards for all Australians, and I hope we're up to that task as well. I would now like to change tack and turn to the Reserve Bank's policy response. To recap, that response has had five elements. First, a reduction in the cash rate to 25 basis points with forward guidance that the cash rate will not be increased until we are making sustainable progress towards our goals of full employment and inflation. Second, the introduction of a target for the yield on three-year government bonds of 25 basis points and a preparedness to buy government bonds in whatever quantities are needed to achieve that target. The third element of the package was the introduction of a term funding facility under which authorised deposit-taking institutions have access to funding from the Reserve Bank for 3 years at 25 basis points, with additional funding available to ADIs if they increase their lending to businesses, especially to small and medium-sized businesses. The fourth element of the package is to use our daily open market operations to make sure that there is plentiful liquidity in the Australian financial system and to use our bond purchases to promote the smooth functioning of the market for government securities. The fifth and final element was the modification of the interest rate corridor system so that balances held in exchange settlement accounts at the Reserve Bank earn 10 basis points rather than zero. This represented a very comprehensive package, and it's an important part of that national effort to build the bridge to the recovery that I spoke about earlier. It was designed to help keep funding costs low right across the economy and to make sure that credit was available to businesses and to households. Following the announcement of this package, the yield on three-year government bonds has declined, and it's now at the target level of 25 basis points, after having been around 50 basis points immediately prior to our announcement. Liquidity in the Australian government bond markets also improved substantially, and this important market is working much better now. Bid-ask spreads are a little wider than they were a couple of months ago, but they've narrowed substantially just recently. To date, the Reserve Bank has bought around $47 billion of government bonds. We bought bonds along the yield curve and bonds issued by the Australian government and by the state and territories. We've done this through daily auctions in the secondary market. The initial purchases were quite large, $4 and $5 billion a day. In those first days, we were keen to underline our commitment to the target and we were seeking to relieve some of the severe dislocation that was apparent in government bond markets at the time. As conditions in the market have improved, the three-year yield has settled around 25 basis points, and we've scaled back our daily bond purchases. Over recent days, the purchases have averaged around $750 million. We are prepared to scale up these purchases again, though, if needed, and we will buy bonds in whatever quantity is needed for us to achieve our target. With conditions more settled at the moment, our plan for the immediate future is to schedule any bond auctions we conduct for 3 days a week, Mondays, Wednesdays and Thursdays. That does not mean that we'll necessarily purchase bonds on each of those days. Whether or not we do so will depend upon the yield on three-year government bonds and on how the market's functioning. It's likely, though, that for the foreseeable future, we'll be purchasing semi-government securities weekly. And as is the case at the moment, we'll announce our intentions at 11:15 each day, and if conditions warrant it, we will return to daily bond purchases. I'd like to restate that we are buying bonds in the secondary market, and we are not buying bonds directly from the government. One of the underlying principles of Australia's institutional arrangements is the separation of monetary and fiscal policy. That is, the central bank does not finance the government. Instead, the government finances itself in the market. This principle has served the country well, and I am confident the Australian federal, state and territory governments will continue to be able to finance themselves in the market, as they should. While we're not directly financing the government, our bond purchases are affecting the market price that the government pays to raise debt. Our policies are also affecting the price that the private sector pays to raise debt. In this way, our actions are affecting funding costs right across the economy, as they should be in the exceptional circumstances that we now face. But our actions should not be confused with the Reserve Bank financing the government. Another element of the recent package was the Term Funding Facility. Around $3 billion of the initial allowance of $90 billion has already been drawn under this facility, with around 35 institutions participating so far. The knowledge that ADIs have access to this scheme over coming months has reduced any concerns that there might have been about possible liquidity strains in the future. In doing so, this scheme has supported confidence that Australia's ADIs will be able to access the liquidity that's needed to support their customers. It's also contributed to the low cost of borrowing new funds at fixed interest rates for both businesses and households. The drawings under this facility, combined with the bond purchases and the Reserve Bank's open market operations, have resulted in the balances held in exchange settlement accounts increasing very substantially. At the beginning of March, these balances stood at around $2.5 billion. Today, they stand at $83 billion. And on the other side of the Reserve Bank's balance sheet, there are increased holdings of government bonds purchased both outright and under repurchase agreements in our daily open market operations. These very large increases in the balances held in exchange settlement accounts has affected the operation of our cash market. The number of transactions in this market has declined as fewer institutions need to borrow settlement balances each day. The cash rate has also drifted below 25 basis points and today is at 15 basis points. Both of these changes are consistent with experience in other countries and they've not come as a surprise to us. The increase in liquidity in the financial system has also resulted in the spread between the bank bill swap rate, BBSW, and the overnight indexed swap rate, the OIS rate, falling significantly. At the three-month horizon, the BBSW-OIS spread is now down around zero, which is the lowest it's been in years. And this has further reduced funding costs for both the banking system and for the non-bank lenders. The increased liquidity in the system has also meant that the Reserve Bank's daily open market operations are now on a smaller scale, and we've adjusted the frequency of our longer-term operations. And we will continue to adjust these operations as required to support the liquidity of the Australian financial system. So that is where we are 4 weeks after the announcement of our policy package. This package, combined with the government's fiscal policies and the work of the banks and many businesses, is building that strong bridge that I've spoken about. Our monetary response is keeping funding costs low right across the country, and it's keeping credit available to businesses and households. The fiscal response is providing significant support to both jobs and incomes. Businesses are also helping their employees by keeping them on wherever they can, and the banks are supporting their customers with more flexible terms. Together, these efforts are helping the Australian economy through a difficult period, and they're positioning us well for the recovery. On that note, thank you very much for listening, and I'm very happy to answer some questions. Thank you.
We will now go to questions. Please limit yourself to one question each. If you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star 2. If you are on a speakerphone, please pick up the handset to ask your question. Your first question comes from Vesna Polyak with the Australian Financial Review. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, what's the governor's position on whether super funds with liquidity issues should be able to participate in the repo facility should they ask for it?
Thank you, listener. The liquidity withdrawal from the super fund industry as a whole is perfectly manageable. For some funds, the withdrawals are going to be quite large, though, and those funds will have to shrink. Some of the scenarios suggest that up to 20 or 25% under funds under management could be withdrawn for some particular funds. But these funds have now had a month to get ready, and they have further time before those withdrawals will take place. So I am confident that they will be able to meet the liquidity demands from their members. If the Reserve Bank was to provide a liquidity support facility, it would need to pass the public interest test, and we'd need to be able to conclude that it was needed to support the stability of the financial system. And at the moment, we're not in a position to conclude that.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Peter Ryan with the ABC. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my question. I was wondering, given everything that you just outlined there, whether you're starting to see any strains in confidence in the financial system in terms of what we saw back in the GFC when institutions were getting a bit scared to lend to each other.
Not at all, Peter. I mean, the banks have a lot of liquidity at the moment. During the financial crisis, there were liquidity concerns at certain points in time. The combination of our bond buying program and liquidity and the term funding facility and our increased repos have given banks the confidence that they will have access to the liquidity that's needed. Credit spreads rose a couple of weeks ago, but they are now in the process of normalizing, and we've seen some issuers return to both the domestic and the foreign market. So at the moment, we're not seeing signs of any stress at all in our financial system, and I've been incredibly impressed by the commitment of the banks to support their customers through this difficult period. As I said in my prepared remarks, the banks are acting as shock absorbers for the economy. In the global financial crisis, not in Australia but elsewhere, the banks were acting as amplifiers. Here they're acting as shock absorbers, which is to our collective benefit.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Patrick Commons with The Australian. Please go ahead.
Oh, thanks very much, Governor. My question is whether the RBA's scenario analysis assumes that the damage to the economy from restrictions, do they compound at a non-linear rate the longer they are in place? Does the damage compound the longer they're in place?
It's possible that that's the case, although I haven't really thought about that scenario in a great deal of detail. But the longer this goes on, then the loss of incomes and the loss of jobs is more pronounced. That's obvious. And the damage to the business sector is more pronounced. And the experience from other recessions is that the more people lose jobs and the more businesses are destroyed, the longer it takes to recover. So how these things compound in practice, it's hard to tell, but it's clear that the longer this goes on, the greater the damage to the economic infrastructure of the country will be.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Jonathan Shapiro with the Australian Financial Review. Please go ahead. Jonathan, your line is live. You might be on mute.
Apologies, I've taken that off mute. Thanks very much. Thank you, Governor. My question relates to bond markets. What is your level of comfort with regard to long-term bond rates, which may be low historically but are high relative to short-term rates in other major bond markets? And is there a risk that the size of government funding tasks creates future dislocations in fixed income markets? Thank you.
As you say, long-term bond rates are very low. They're very low in terms of our history. I think right at the moment, the 10-year yield is at 0.83%. So the Australian government can borrow for 10 years at less than 1%, and it can borrow for 3 years at 0.25%. So the borrowing costs are incredibly low. They're as low as they've ever been. I don't have particular concerns that the government's borrowing task will cause dislocation in these markets again. Last week, the government raised, I think, $13 billion. This week, it's raising another $5 or $6 or $7 billion. So over 2 weeks, it's raised $20 billion. And I expect that we'll return to the markets each of the following weeks with substantial bond raisings as well. At the moment, I don't have any concerns that that's going to cause dislocation in the market. The liaison that we're doing both with the domestic investors and overseas investors is that there's strong demand for Australian government securities, as there should be. We have a very high credit rating. We have one of the lowest stocks of public debt on issue. We're managing the health crisis much better than many other economies, and we will get through this in a strong position. So I don't have any concerns that people want to buy Australian government bonds.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Stephen Halmarik with the Commonwealth Bank. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you, and thank you, Phil, for taking the questions. So you talked about reinvigorating growth and productivity. I'm just wondering what you think is on the list, what should be the priority for the government to reinvigorate productivity? And a quick second question, if I can, what's your assumptions on the participation rate for the labour market and the impact of that on the unemployment rate? Thank you.
On the first question, I think the overall challenge is to make Australia a great place where businesses want to expand, innovate, invest and hire people. And if we can do that, then we'll drive higher living standards for all Australians. How do we do that? How do we make Australia a great place to invest, expand, innovate and hire people? Well, I think we start off by reading the multitude of reports that have already been commissioned on this issue, and perhaps I could run through you at a very high level what those reports say. They say we should be looking again at the way we tax income generation, consumption and land in this country. They say we should be looking at how we build and price infrastructure. They say we should be looking at how we train our students and our workforce so they've got the skills for the modern economy. They say we should be looking at how various regulations promote or perhaps hinder innovation. And they say we should be looking at the flexibility and complexity of our industrial relations system. So they're broad areas. I don't want to advocate particular policies at the moment within each of those areas, but there's plenty of advice out there from various other bodies and in these reports that have been commissioned. And I'm hopeful that the spirit of cooperative behaviour that we're now seeing will actually translate into being able to address some of these issues. You asked about the assumption on the participation rate. And here again, we're working with various scenarios because it's very hard to know whether people who have been stood down are going to be actively looking for jobs or they're just going to wait until their business recovers. So at the moment, our main focus on the labour market is on total hours worked. I think we have a better handle on how total hours worked are going to evolve. And as I said, they're expected to be down 20% in the June quarter, which is a staggering number. And how that then plays out in terms of unemployment and participation and people not being in the labour force, I think it's very hard to tell. It really depends upon the success that firms have in keeping their employees attached to them while they're stood down. But I think for the next little while, our main focus will be on total hours worked in the economy. That'll be the best guide to kind of how quickly we're recovering when we see hours worked start picking up again.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Shane Wright with The Age. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Governor. I'm just wondering, a couple of years ago, the banking regulators and yourselves came to a position around investors and moving them away from, say, interest-only loans and towards principal and interest. Is it now time to reconsider some of those policies, given the real strain that's being placed across the property market on investors who may have lost and on their tenants who may not be able to pay their rent?
Well, both the restrictions on investors and on interest-only loans were both removed last year, or it's even further back than that. So those restrictions are no longer in place. So it's hard to argue that they're a factor in the current dynamics in the housing market. I think the property market is likely to go through a difficult period over the coming months, but it's not because of these restrictions, and there's no capacity to remove these restrictions to boost the market.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Rory Robertson with the Westpac Group Treasury. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Governor Lowe. Thanks for your thoughtful update on this extraordinary episode. Today's reported 6% fall in employment over the past month is literally off the charts. So on the bright side, the past month has also brought dramatic declines in new COVID-19 cases and hospitalisations to impressively low levels, despite thousands of resolved COVID-19 cases and serious comparisons with the Spanish flu. So far in Australia, only 3 people under 60 years of age have died. So my question is, given recent excellent news on the health front and with the National Cabinet flagging a start to a modest, gradual, bit-by-bit easing of restrictions after the Anzac Day weekend, are you increasingly hopeful that a significant economic recovery can begin in coming months? Thank you.
Well, I listened to the Prime Minister's press conference before coming down here this afternoon, and he did say that we're now on the road back and we've reached a turning point. He followed that up by saying that the current restrictions need to stay in place for some time because we don't want to have a major setback here. There's been an unbelievably huge effort by Australians to get us to this very good position we're in now. And I'm hopeful that if we can continue that effort, then the restrictions will be able to be eased in time and that within 3 or 4 months we'll start the recovery. But for us to recover, we do need to keep the virus under control and we have to rely on the health experts there. But the next, as I said in my remarks, the next few months are going to be very difficult. And today's data from the ABS saying that there was a 6% decline in the number of jobs in the country in the past 3 weeks just reminds us just how significant the contraction is. So I hope the effort that we've all put in to reduce the incidence of the virus continues and that we can start recovering in a few months' time.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Philip Lasker with the ABC. Please go ahead.
Governor, you said not so long ago, just a moment ago, that the more businesses that are destroyed, the longer it takes for the recovery, for the economic recovery. Is it wise under those circumstances then to rule out any type of assistance to prevent companies from collapsing? Is it wise, for example, for governments to rule out providing low interest loans to companies or investing or providing equity to those companies, particularly if those companies are in strategically important sectors or in labour-intensive sectors? But after all, we're going to see structural damage to the jobs market as well as a result of this. And also, why are you reluctant to use the word recession?
I'm not reluctant to use it, but I think this is kind of better described as an economic contraction. Now, you can use the word recession if you want, but I'm thinking this is a kind of a very marked economic contraction. Is very different to the business cycle downturns that we've seen over the past 50 or 60 years. It's a once-in-a-century event leading to a marked economic contraction from which we'll recover from. And for me, it's the issue. The label isn't particularly important, but it is a once-in-a-century economic contraction. You asked about kind of the government providing assistance and how is that appropriate. And the government has already provided huge amounts of assistance to businesses to keep them afloat. In the first couple of policy packages. There were large payments to small businesses, cash payments to keep them afloat. The government has delayed or deferred many charges on businesses as well. And the wage subsidy program is really helping many businesses keep afloat and to keep the workers connected to the business, which is incredibly important as well. So the government has done an extraordinary amount so far. We can always debate whether it should take further steps, but I think it's appropriate at the moment to pause and to examine the evidence on the success of the program so far.
Thank you. Your next question comes from John Kehoe with Australian Financial Review. Please go ahead.
Governor, thank you for the speech and making yourself available for questions. You mentioned that headline inflation could very well turn negative this year. There are some credible economists out there who are worried about deflation more over the medium term, pointing to some sort of negative spiral between wages and inflation and the hours worked, some of those trends you're talking to. Doesn't that mean that invariably or inevitably we're going to need pretty serious ongoing fiscal and monetary support for quite a while, even beyond the initial emergency, just to counteract the threat or risk of deflation, which could be very damaging over the medium term?
Well, I don't think we're going to have deflation over the medium term. In the next quarter, we've got some very specific and unusual events which are going to drive the inflation rate low into negative territory probably, and that's the big decline in oil prices and the introduction of free childcare immediately. So they're events that are unlikely to be repeated. So I think at some point oil prices will probably rise again and the government won't keep on cutting childcare prices. So I think inflation will, after a period, normalise. But I also think that we're going to have low interest rates for a very long period of time. As I've said on previous occasions, we will not be increasing the cash rate until we're confident that inflation is going to be between 2 and 3% on a sustainable basis. When we release our forecasts in a couple of weeks, you'll see that inflation over the horizon is not going to be between 2 and 3% over the next 2 or 3 years. So I think it's quite likely that we have the current setting of interest rate for a number of years. And this is reinforced by our target on 3-year yields of 25 basis points. I think it's quite likely that we'll be at this level of interest rate for years. And low level of interest rates and fiscal support, I think, will be enough to get the economy growing at a reasonable pace and over time, wage growth to gradually pick up. Wage growth previously was not fast enough to deliver 2.5% inflation. And as I said in my prepared remarks, wage growth is going to slow. And I think it'll be a couple of years before it's back to the current rate. So we're going to have low inflation and low interest rates for quite a long period of time. That's the world we currently live in.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Michael Pascoe with The New Daily. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Governor. The gap between the emergency funding now in place, 6-month time limit on it from the government, and the eventual impact of the worthy productivity initiatives you mentioned, there is a big gap between those two events. The bridge would seem to be considerably longer than 6 months. Do you envisage further funding will be needed in order to prevent the real unemployment rate going significantly above 6%?
Well, it really depends upon how long the restrictions remain in place. But I was encouraged by the press conference of the Prime Minister and the Chief Medical Officer and the Health Minister. They were saying that they think we're on the road back. And if we stay on that road, then these restrictions will be progressively lifted. And as that happens, economic activity will return towards normal. I think we all hope that that takes place as quickly as possible.
Hoping could mean we're caught short when it doesn't.
It's there are various scenarios here, and in our statement of monetary policy to be released in a few weeks' time, we'll outline some of those scenarios. None of us have a crystal ball here, so it is possible that the virus reappears and we can't loosen off the restrictions. In that scenario, the loss of jobs and incomes is even more staggering than I outlined in the central scenarios. But we shouldn't catastrophise here. The current signs are positive on the health front, and if they can continue, then they'll turn positive on the economic front as well.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Prashant Nunaha with TD Securities. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Governor. A question on the bond buying conducted by the RBA so far. Why has the RBA not purchased duration beyond the 10-year segment of the curve? Does the bank believe that the segment of that curve is functioning smoothly, or are there other issues at play?
We've had two main focuses. One is to get the three-year yield at 25 basis points. To do that, we've bought a lot of securities at the short end, as you would expect. And the second objective was to improve market functioning. And the area of the curve that we'd focused most on was between 3 and 10 years. And as we've purchased those securities, the market is working more effectively. And we also hear from our liaison that as we've improved the functioning of that part of the market has also improved for the longer-term securities, the ones between 10 and 30 years. So we're hopeful that there's this gradual process of normalisation taking place, and that starting at the securities less than 10 years has facilitated that process. We don't have any in principle objection to buying the longer securities, but we focused our purchases where we thought they'd be most effective, and that was around the three-year mark and out to 10 years.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Matthew Cranston with the Financial Review. Please go ahead.
Dr. Lowe, I'm just wondering if you can give some views on the traditional transmission channels of your monetary policy and how that's going to work. I noticed you've said that $3 billion out of the $90 billion in that facility has gone through to 35 institutions, but how deeply does that go into the economy? How many people will take up cheap loans, and how valuable and how worthwhile are cheaper loans, and do they get through in all those traditional mechanisms?
Well, I said that 35 institutions have so far drawn funding under the term funding facilities, but I'm expecting that over the coming months that every single financial institution will draw funding under that scheme. Initially, not everyone has because they haven't got their liquidity plans to the state where they're in the position to draw on the funding, but I'm confident that they will, and we've spoken to most of Australia's financial institutions, and they say they're going to draw under the scheme. And I'm confident that with institutions being able to raise funds at 25 basis points, that will, in time, be passed through to lower cost of funding for their mortgage customers and their business customers. You saw that immediately after we made the announcement of this policy package, a number of the banks cut their interest rates by 100 basis points to small and medium-sized businesses. So there was an immediate transmission, and partly that was on the back of our announcement. So I think it's working. The other way that it's working is giving institutions the confidence that they will have access to liquidity. In difficult financial times, institutions might worry that they can't get funding and therefore they don't want to lend. We've taken that risk off the table for Australian financial institutions. They will have access to funding, we'll make sure of that, and the cost of that funding will be low. Through the process of competition, I think that eventually leads to lower funding costs and credit being available to businesses and households. And the other point that I would make here is that I've been incredibly impressed by the commitment of the banks to do the right thing by their customers. They understand that they're part of Team Australia, that they have a role to play in keeping the economy running. So that commitment to being on Team Australia plus the competitive dynamics that come from having guaranteed access to funding at lower interest rates, we'll see lower funding costs and more credit available to both businesses and households, which in time will help. The lower exchange rate also has an effect on the currency, which in time, again, will help.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Will Caloris with CNBC. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Governor. I was just wondering, in terms of, you know, you mentioned the banks being the shock absorbers for the economy, they're the main transmission method in terms of a lot of the funding support. Would it be your preference for them to forego paying dividends, much like we're seeing in New Zealand, until we see some kind of clarity as to the economic impact moving forward?
Well, they're certainly going to cut back dividends, which I think is entirely appropriate. APRA made an announcement on this issue last week or the week before last. I think that was appropriate that financial institutions cut back dividends. Got to remember, though, that Australia's banks have very high levels of capital. We've undertaken extensive stress testing. In all those stress tests, they maintain well capitalised. So they have the ability to pay dividends, and some Australians rely on those dividends for their income. So there's a balance to be struck, and by cutting back dividends from where they were over the past couple of years, I think we're moving in the right direction to strike that right balance. But I don't think they need to be banned.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Sarah Turner with the AFR. Please go ahead.
Hello, thanks for taking my question. I'm just wondering how you see the Australian dollar's role as a shock absorber this time around. Do you think it's going to be as effective as it has been in the past, given that the forecasts for global demand are pretty weak at the moment?
Well, as you say, the exchange rate has been a shock absorber in the past, and my view, looking at the economic history for the past 30 years, is the exchange rate has been the great shock absorber. It's stabilised the economy more than anything else, perhaps even more than our own monetary policy. The exchange rate at the moment is working as it normally would. Earlier in the year, it was in the high 60s. It came down more than we expected a month ago, as investors were engaged in blind selling of assets to generate cash. But as that period of panic has passed, the exchange rate's come up a bit, but it's still down very significantly on the year. And that's helping stabilise the economy. At the moment, there may be not very much imports and exports taking place, but once the restrictions start lifting, the lower currency that we have will help our exporters and domestic industries. So it's working as normal. But a few weeks ago, there was kind of a very large depreciation as people panicked, but that panic has now passed.
Thank you. That does bring us to the end of our conference, and that does conclude our conference call for today. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.
Thank you.